This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
There's been some very frenzied activity on the Mediterranean. More than 6,600 migrants hoping to reach Europe were rescued in the Mediterranean in the past few days. Many operations coordinated by the Italian Coast Guard. Some 3,000 were picked up in 20 operations on Saturday alone.
That's reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. We'll have the full story coming up. Also, the release of 82 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted by Boko Haram in Chibok is seen as a victory for a social media campaign. Nigeria's president leaves for London on medical leave, as his office calls it, a follow-up medical consultation. And France's president-elect takes part in ceremonies today commemorating the end of World War II. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the release of 82 Nigerian schoolgirls abducted in 2014 by Boko Haram militants from a school in Chibok is seen as a victory for a social media campaign that has pressured the Nigerian government to recover the girls. Chika Adua reports on the influence of social media in the Chibok girls' story.
Kwana Simon, Phoebe Haruna, Esther Usman, Siratu Ayuba. These are some of the young women who were recently released by Boko Haram in exchange for prisoners, according to the Nigerian presidency. 82 of the young women known as the Chibok Girls gained their freedom last weekend. It's been 3 long years for the Chibok Girls, and throughout it all, social media campaigners have kept pressure on the Nigerian government to recover the girls.
The failure, state failure, created a situation where those girls were abducted from school.
Iman Shehu is a member of the Bring Back Our Girls group in Abuja. The campaign is arguably the most successful grassroots citizens movement in Nigeria's recent history. For 3 years, members have gathered across the Nigerian capital of Abuja and the city of Lagos, carrying banners and marching the streets. But the Bring Back Our Girls group has made its loudest mark on social media. Like the other members, Shehu campaigns on Twitter, Facebook, and WhatsApp. The Bring Back Our Girls WhatsApp group has more than 100 participants, including journalists, elected officials, and concerned citizens. Thousands of followers get alerts from the group's Twitter feed. When dozens of Chibok parents were blocked by police from entering the state house last month, it was the Bring Back Our Girls group who published pictures of the botched rally on their social media channels. It's on social media that the group's slogans have become known. Slogans like Bring Back Our Girls Now and Alive and We Are Fighting for the Soul of Nigeria have all been popularized on social media.
What do we want?
Our girls back now and alive.
As it has turned out, when we first started saying it in our slogan, without really thinking much about it, that the fight for the Chibok girls is the fight for the soul of Nigeria, it has truly become evident that we are actually fighting. And for those of us in the movement, this has become the basis to continue.
Nigerian officials have made repeated references to the social media campaign of Bring Back Our Girls. A tweet from BBOG activist Obi Ezekwesili can be retweeted thousands of times. The group released a statement commending Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari on recovering the 82 girls. But the group is back on social media, pressuring on behalf of the 113 who are still missing. No one knows where they are or if they're even still alive. But the Nigerian president has vowed to ensure that all the Chibok girls return to their families. Chika Odua for VOA News in Dakar, Senegal.
Thank you, Chika. After meeting yesterday with the Chibok schoolgirls just freed from Boko Haram captivity, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari left for London on medical leave. His office calls it a follow-up medical consultation. Buhari has returned to Nigeria in early March after spending 2 months in London. His office says there's no reason to worry, but it's not known why the 74-year-old leader needs medical treatment. Buhari has canceled many public appearances in recent weeks. Some complain that in his absence, important government work is not getting done. Jibrin Ibrahim is a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja. VOA's William Eagle asked him what the Constitution says about a president who may not be able to fulfill his duties.
The Constitution says if people feel that the president is not in a position to continue to carry out his duties, duty sickness, then the Federal Executive Council, that's all ministers, would sit. And if they vote by a two-thirds majority, then a panel of medical experts is constituted to assert the facts of the case. If they are certain that the president is not fit to carry out his duties, then he must step down and hand over to his deputy.
His deputy being, in this case, the vice president, Yemi Osinbajo.
That's correct.
Mr. Osinbajo is a Christian from the south, and President Buhari is Muslim from the north. If the president steps down or relinquishes for any reason his title and Mr. Osinbajo takes over, how does this affect the idea of rotating the presidency from among Nigeria's regions?
No, it doesn't affect it in any way. Don't forget that we've gone through this when 7 years ago today, President Umaru Musa Yar'Adua died and his vice president, Goodluck Jonathan, took over. It's a situation in which there's no politics that comes into it because the president is dead and the constitution is clear that whoever is the vice president takes over automatically. Mm-hmm. So the debates and arguments start after the tenure of the dead president. That's when there would be a debate whether the then new president should contest or should not contest. And that would be a matter of if the person then holding the presidency is in a position to generate sufficient political support to contest or he is not.
Has governance been affected by President Buhari's absence?
Long before even the president fell ill, governance had been extremely slow, and a lot of things that were supposed to have been done had not been done. We are now almost 2 years to the end of the tenure, and over 70% of heads of agencies have still not been appointed. So I think there's been a very general process of very slow administration and governance. And of course, the sickness of the president just added to that pre-existing condition.
Has there been any public comments by the president's All Progressives Party or the opposition People's Democratic Party? Have they taken any positions on this matter?
Yes, the opposition People's Democratic Party have called for the president to step down on the basis of his being unwell. The ruling All People's Congress have opposed that. But I think the key thing is that what most Nigerians are saying is that if the president is indeed sick, he should seek for the best medical attention possible.
And what are you, as a political scientist, watching? Are there any angles to this story that you are following specifically?
For us, the important issue is to ensure that if the president is indeed very sick, as he appears to be, that he seeks the required medical attention. Our general concern is that is it a situation in which the entourage around the president, for their own personal benefits, are persuading him against his better judgment not to go out and seek for medical care? Of course, this is a speculative concern because we don't have any specific information about it. But a lot of us are very worried about that possibility.
That was Jibrin Ibrahim, a senior fellow at the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja. He spoke with VOA's William Eagle. France held ceremonies today commemorating the end of World War II in 1945. France's president-elect Emmanuel Macron took part in the event along with current president François Hollande. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris is following the aftermath of France's presidential election in which the far-right candidate was defeated in a landslide. She spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua first about today's ceremonies.
The occasion is the end of the war in Europe, the 8th of May. It's a traditional holiday here in France. It's a very somber time when people remember the devastation that was caused in France in the Second World War. And it's also become a tradition in presidential election year when the outgoing president invites the president-elect to come to the Arc de Triomphe, to lay a wreath, to rekindle the flame of the unknown soldier, and to just show that France comes together to remember its fallen and also to remind people of just what damage war has done to this country and what it could do.
Now, some have raised concerns about his ability to govern France, being that he does not come from a traditional party. What are you hearing?
That's a real problem for him, to be honest. He doesn't have the party base. Now, it's worked for him as having this movement to be able to get the presidency because it's been a one-on-one. At the end of the day, it was just him versus Marine Le Pen. When it comes to getting deputies into the National Assembly and the elections are in June, he's got to fight against established parties. Now, these established parties are very strong on the constituency level. On top of that, when it comes to the local elections, these elections, it's not a one-on-one. The second round is between candidates who scored more than 12.5% of the vote. So he's going to find that he's actually up against several opponents from established parties, from parties who have had people working on the ground in constituencies. Now, if he doesn't manage to get an absolute majority in Parliament or even a working majority, then believe you me, the first person who's going to be rubbing her hands and saying, "See, I told you he couldn't do it, he couldn't move on," will be Marine Le Pen, the woman who he was up against in that second round of the French presidential election.
Now, did he say whether he would continue any of Hollande's policies?
The biggest policy that he has said he will stay with is France's place in the world, and particularly in Europe. Emmanuel Macron has said that he believes that the European Union is the foundation of Europe's post-World War II stability and economic prosperity, and that he believes that Europe can play a positive role in the world. He's also said that France will stay within NATO, that there will be a continuity with the past 10 years when France rejoined the operational wing of NATO. He's also said that outside of Europe, that France will continue its engagement. And in particular, we're looking there at France having troops in Mali and Mauritania, and also France, which has been part of the airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against the so-called Islamic State. Further away from France, of course, France has been playing an active part in defense in the Pacific and in the South Pacific, but also that France will take its view of democracy and really uphold what it feels is its almost like its duty to keep this democratic process going outside of France.
Now, with the rejection of the far-right candidate, what does that mean for Muslims and migrants in France?
One of the things I noticed when I was out either with the Macron campaign or when I was at his victory celebration last night was just how many immigrants were there, people who were either immigrants or were children of immigrants. This has been a party that's really appealed to everybody. He's particularly gone out of his way, Emmanuel Macron, to say, everybody who is French, everyone who lives here, is welcome. Even last year, when we had the migrant crisis and you had people coming across the Mediterranean, boats risking their lives, he said that something has to be done for these people. You can't just close the door. He said everybody can have a religion and everyone has a place here in France.
That's reporter Catherine Field in Paris. She spoke to VOA's Joe DiCapua. Coming up on 20 Minutes Past the Hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. More than 6,000 migrants were rescued off the coast of Libya over the weekend. However, another migrant boat tragedy has been reported. From Rome, reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments. She spoke with me about the busy weekend of rescues, fears of more boat tragedies, and her recent visit to a migrant center.
There's been some very frenzied activity on the Mediterranean. More than 6,600 migrants hoping to reach Europe were rescued in the Mediterranean in the past few days. Many operations coordinated by the Italian Coast Guard. Some 3,000 were picked up in 20 operations on Saturday alone. And that involved coordination between the Italian Navy, the Coast Guard, the EU border agency Frontex, and several NGOs, including Doctors Without Borders. Now, some of these migrants have already been taken to shore in Italy, including 730 on board a ship operated by Doctors Without Borders. But we're still seeing more rescues and migrants being ferried to the Italian coastline today.
I understand that the International Organization of Migration is saying that 113 people are missing and that the Libyan Coast Guard has saved 7 people.
Yes, there are fears of yet another tragedy in the Mediterranean. The International Organization for Migration is quoting reports coming out of Libya saying that the Coast Guard has saved 7 migrants, 6 men and 1 woman, off the coast of Libya. And yet, according to the testimony of one of the survivors, there are still 113 migrants unaccounted for from that particular vessel. So a great deal of concern there about what's happened to those migrants, and concern that even with all these activities and operations that are underway, that the rescue vessels just can't get to these people quick enough to save their lives.
And on another angle of this story, you visited a migrant center in Ventimiglia. What was that like?
Late last year, I visited Ventimiglia and saw a migrant center where several hundred migrants were being fed and clothed and managed by the Red Cross. But there was also a priest in the town of Ventimiglia who is housing migrants in his parish. His name is Father Rito, and he comes from South America, but he has around 60 migrants in his parish. And I spoke to him just a couple of days ago, and he said that he has great demand from migrants. He has, at the moment, he's hosting migrants from the Ivory Coast and South Sudan. Many of them are unaccompanied minors, some of them young children there with their parents, but great concern about the demand for services, for food, for shelter. And interestingly, this priest said that many of these migrants still do not want to stay in Italy. Their intention is to move from Italy into other European countries, particularly France, even though, as we know, the border controls are much tighter in countries like France, Switzerland, and Austria.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome. UN climate talks opened in Bonn, Germany today amid concern the United States might pull out of the Paris Climate Agreement adopted in December 2015. During the U.S. presidential campaign, then-candidate Donald Trump promised to withdraw from the agreement that President Obama supported. There are numerous calls in Bonn for the U.S. to remain in the Paris Agreement. Paula Caballero is global director of the World Resources Institute's climate program. She said preventing global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius is at risk.
We're facing a very significant gap because current action plans for tackling climate change will not enable us to stay well below 2 degrees as we agreed to in Paris. So clearly, more needs to be done. And Bonn is a critical milestone along the way in terms of defining how we're going to increase and set ambition for 2020.
She also commented on the political situations in France and the U.S. and how they relate to climate change negotiations.
I am very pleased to see the results of the French election. I believe that President Macron will have a strong incentive to build upon the enormous success that Paris represented and the kind of leadership in international climate diplomacy that has become a hallmark of French leadership. With regards to the question of what the decision will ultimately be from the Trump administration, I wish to underline that it is important for the U.S. to understand that it would be a very grave mistake to leave the Paris Agreement. It will undermine and erode the U.S.'s legacy and standing in the international arena. And if it decides to withdraw or to downsize its national climate commitments, it would really mark a new era of isolationism for the U.S., and it will signal to the rest of the world that the U.S. will not honor its commitments. It will undermine also the opportunities for innovation, for economic growth, and for jobs. And it also has security implications. The Department of Defense of the U.S. itself has called climate change a threat multiplier.
Also addressing the Bonn climate talks today was Sue Reed, Vice President for Climate and Energy at the nonprofit sustainability organization Ceres.
It's really important to keep in mind that companies the world over have been waking up to the imperative to act on climate. They are seeing impacts in their operations and their supply chains. They're seeing the economic advantages of moving forward on clean energy transition, and they see the extraordinary risks associated with inadequate action on climate change. They're taking action on climate because it makes good business sense. Public and private companies such as Apple, Google, Mars, and General Mills are setting science-based targets to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions across their operations and supply chains, and they're setting and meeting ambitious clean energy targets.
She said in the U.S., more than 1,000 companies and investors have signed a statement supporting climate change efforts.
Just today, in a full-page ad that's running in the New York Times, major corporations including Apple, Google, Morgan Stanley, Ingersoll Rand, Intel, and Microsoft are calling on President Trump to stay in the Paris Agreement, to secure American competitiveness, to create jobs and markets and economic growth. What's at stake is nothing less than American and global prosperity. And there is widespread recognition that any country that decreases its ambitions under the Paris Agreement stands to lose out.
The U.S. has sent a delegation to the climate talks, but it's smaller than in years past. The Bonn talks will continue through May 18th. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host Shaka Salee. Every Wednesday night, Trade Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the future of sub-Saharan Africa's development lies in the hands of its youth. In her new book, Ambassador Robin Renee Sanders says growth and progress is being driven by small and medium-sized enterprises. That's on the next Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.